Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the 13th Annual Sandra Goldberg Lecture. I'm Cappy Flanders, co-chair of the Council on Palliative Care. Sandra Goldberg, in whose memory this lecture is named, was an amazing woman, a social worker, but most importantly, a good and loyal friend. And as ever, we are enormously grateful to her family for their continued support. Our additional sponsors this year are the Beattie Memorial Lectures Committee of McGill University, Canada Heritage, and of course us, the Council on Palliative Care. Thank you all. This year we welcome our first encore presenter, Dr. Kathleen Foley, whom we've had the pleasure of hearing when she spoke at the second Goldberg Lecture in 1999. But first I would like to speak about André Picard, our moderator tonight, who in a few minutes will tell you more about Dr. Foley and will also take charge of the whole evening. Many of you will recognize Monsieur Picard's name as he is the well-known public health reporter for the Globe and Mail. His work has been widely acclaimed. He has been honored with the Michener Award for Meritorious Public Service Journalism, the Canadian Policy Research Award, and the Atkinson Fellowship for Public Policy Research. In 2002, he received the Centennial Prize of the Pan American Health Organization as the top health reporter in the Americas. In 2005, he was named Canada's first public health hero, I love that, by the Canadian Public Health Association. And in 2007, he was honored as a champion of mental health. In addition, he received the Canadian Nurses Association Award of Excellence for Healthcare Reporting, the Nursing in the Media Award of the Registered Nurses Association of Ontario, the International Media Prize of Sigma Theta Tau, the Nursing Honor Society, and the Science and Society Book Prize. Well, that certainly puts the gold star that I won in pre-kindergarten into perspective, doesn't it? But as if that were not enough, André has also written three highly regarded books on nursing, on charitable giving, and on the tragedy surrounding the contaminated blood scandal. He brings something very special to tonight's lecture and is a great fit with the work of the Council on Palliative Care. You've seen the slides that were up when you came in, and all of you have the most recent council newsletter, both of which give you some idea of the work we do. The subject of tonight's lecture is, of course, of importance to everyone, but it is also this year's lecturer, Dr. Foley, who brings such clarity, thoughtfulness, and integrity to this emotion-laden and often controversial subject, and who makes such a valuable contribution in so many ways that makes this evening special. We invited her back, not because we ran out of eligible speakers, but just simply because she's the best. Please tell your friends who may not have been able to attend tonight's lecture that it will be available on the website of the Council on Palliative Care and also on Canal Savoir. And now, please welcome André Picard.
Well, thank you, Cappy, for that very kind introduction. I'll try and make my introduction shorter. I don't like to hear about all those prizes. And I'm an old-fashioned person, so I have old-fashioned paper. So welcome once again to the 2010 Sandra Goldberg Memorial Lecture, and welcome to the people who are watching us online as well. Bienvenue à McGill, pour tout le monde. The topic tonight is palliative care, shedding light on euthanasia. It's my pleasure and privilege to be able to introduce the distinguished invited speaker tonight, Dr. Kathleen Foley. But before I do, I just want to give you a couple of quick housekeeping notes. Premièrement, je veux dire que le discours ce soir sera en anglais uniquement, mais on a de la traduction simultanée. Alors, si vous avez besoin d'un écouteur, allez-y discrètement à la porte. On a des écouteurs pour tout le monde qui en veut. So what I was saying to people in French was a whole bunch of stuff about hockey, in case you didn't understand. Not important for the rest of you. After the lecture, there's going to be a question period. We have mics up front, so we'll ask you at the end to come down quietly and join the line for questions so that people can hear online and in the auditorium. There will also be a reception, so we want you to stick around afterwards and mingle, and you'll have a lot of stimulating discussion to have after the lecture. Now, the last housekeeping item is I have to ask everyone, before we start, to turn off their cell phones, their Blackberries, iPhones, and any other addictive devices you carry around. You can leave your pacemakers on, that's okay. And we promise to finish before the hockey game starts, so there's no excuse for peeking at the Blackberries tonight or the iPhones. We'll be done by 7. So now to the business at hand, the important part of the evening, the introduction of Dr. Kathleen Fowley. She's an attending physician in the pain and palliative care service at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City. She's also a professor of neurology, neuroscience, and clinical pharmacology at the Weill Medical College of Cornell University. And I could spend a long time listing a whole bunch of other titles and honors that she has. There's a long, very impressive CV. But what I'd like to do instead is give you in very lay terms why it's such an honor for all of us to be here tonight and to welcome her to Montreal. Dr. Fowley is a pioneer in the understanding and the treatment of cancer pain, and in pain more generally. She's been an inspirational leader in the field of end-of-life care for academics and people in the lay audience as well. Dr. Fowley is not only a superb researcher and academic, that's important, but she presents her work in a way that it's understandable to the general public. And that's her real gift, and you're going to see that gift in action tonight. Her work has helped me, and no doubt many of you and others far and wide, to understand that palliative care is an important public health issue. It's not just an individual issue. It has implications for all of society. What I learned from reading her work is that a good death is as important as a good life. And I think you'll hear that message resonate tonight. Dr. Fowley has helped transform the culture of death in North America and beyond. And I have no doubt you'll find her lecture tonight transformative. So, Dr. Fowley, without further ado, the podium is yours.
Thank you, Andre, and thank you so much for having the opportunity to be here. And I know that this is a slightly charged topic, and it is one that I always, as I sit and write about it and think about it, reflect on my patients' experiences. And so perhaps we'll have the opportunity to talk in the more pragmatic senses. But what I was hoping to do this evening was to start by thanking the Council on Palliative Care, thanking the enormous efforts of Kathy Flanders and the Council for inviting me back this time. And also to honor the family of Sandra Goldberg, because I think it's really so important to have lectures that memorialize individuals who've made contributions and, in this sense, made contributions to palliative care. So I thank the Goldberg family for that. So with that, I'm going to sort of take you through a whirlwind of different issues that I think are important and that we need to think about. And very much from the perspective that this needs to be a public discussion and we need to be open and transparent and be able to have this in the most civil way that we can, because it's important and it's enormously personal. And I think the difficulty is, how do you make something that's so personal a public policy? So as we sort of move along in this, I want to start again by honoring what leadership has come from Canada. And if we look at the history of the global hospice movement, it's quite an extraordinary history. It basically was an individual, Cecily Saunders, who developed a natural experiment of taking dying patients, of putting them in an institution, caring for them, trying to treat their pain with the use of opioid drugs, and then studying them. And what she did was to honor those seriously ill individuals at probably the most vulnerable point in time of their lives. Balfour Mount is the individual who coined the term and created the term palliative care because of the translation of hospice into French and the important need to have a word that more broadly defined what has now become the language of an international policy. So we need to thank Bao for that contribution, because it is the contribution of how we now look from a public health perspective of the policies related to palliative care, and within that framework, hospice. And so language like comfort care or supportive care is used, but the public policies are all around the language of palliative care, and I'll come back to that definition. In the United States, it was somewhat of a different approach. Clearly, the leadership of Cecily Saunders was important, but it was a grassroots movement. And this was a grassroots movement by individuals who were fiercely independent, who were wanting to take control back from the medical community, and wanted to be able to assure that people could be at home, who be cared for, and who could die at home. And it was from that grassroots movement that we developed a hospice care policy in the United States. But for each of these groups along the way, they have often been accused of hastening the death of patients because they gave them morphine, of producing addicts in this population. And they've been criticized at each step for the potential of caring, how they've cared for this population of patients. And so, in fact, one sees that there's sort of a close association between the concerns for how we care for the dying and sort of the public policy around that issue. Another person in Canada that's very important is the incredible work and contributions of Neil MacDonald. One of these texts, Symptom Relief and Terminal Illness, was edited and published by Neil. And Neil was a major member of the WHO committees as we drafted these monographs, focusing on relief of pain in cancer patients and focusing on the development of a broader construct of palliative care. And it was really from this early work in the 1980s and then even more recently that the definition of the World Health Organization for palliative care was changed. And Neil played a major role, he with Eduardo Barrera, another Canadian palliative care physician at that time, who were on the committee, and you can almost see Neil's language in this definition, of putting forth this definition of palliative care. So there's, I think, we are much to be thankful to our Canadian colleagues who have helped lead this field forward and advance it. And this is the definition that I think you're well familiar with, that palliative care is an approach. It improves quality of life. It's for patients who are facing life-threatening illness. And this was the change in the definition in 2002, away from the constructs of curable or incurable, to be able to be much more broader and encompassing from the cancer population to the broader population of patients with a variety of chronic illnesses and the need for palliative care for that population of patients. I think there's a really important statement here. It's the prevention and the relief of suffering. And what is more important in any public health agenda than to be able to prevent needless suffering? And then the early identification and specific and impeccable assessment. Impeccable, I think, is Neil's word. The treatment of pain and other problems, physical, psychosocial, and spiritual. So this is the term, this is the definition. Various countries have adapted this definition, but this is the framing that, at a public health level, is one that we use to be able to talk about these policies. So why is it a public health issue? Well, clearly it's been important because the World Health Organization has seen it as a public health issue. They've seen it as integral to the care of patients with life-limiting illnesses, to the care of patients with chronic illness, and have now published a series of documents. It affects all people because all of us will die, except Americans because we think we have a choice. There's a need for information on end-of-life care, and this is well recognized. But it's the potential to prevent suffering that I want to spend a few minutes on, and clearly we think also the potential to prevent disease. And this construct of palliative care as a prevention model is now being widely studied, predominantly in Africa, predominantly in an AIDS population, in the care of patients with HIV/AIDS, because of the opportunity there to prevent needless suffering by, one, preventing spread of the disease. And this is done by community-based peer counselors who are caring for patients in rural areas of much of Africa, who are able to describe what HIV/AIDS is, how you contract it, how you can prevent having AIDS, and what treatments are available. And so this group of community workers who began as palliative care volunteers have become now this incredible force of being able to play a much larger role at a community-based level in prevention. But at the same time, preventing needless suffering by using the treatment of opportunistic infections and by being able to provide appropriate pain relief to those patients with HIV/AIDS. If one has a prevention model in public health, then it's critical to have peer education, and this is what we're seeing. It needs to be patient-centered, so delivered at the site where the patient is, most likely in their home or in the community, not necessarily in a tertiary academic healthcare setting. And it requires the incorporation of self-management programs in teaching people how to do this. And palliative care is very much this kind of model as both public health and as prevention. I think it's also critically important when we begin to talk about the rights that individual patients have, because we've now been working very closely with Human Rights Watch and with other international rights-based organizations to address this construct that palliative care is a human rights issue. And both the Human Rights Council has come forth with a declaration supporting that construct of palliative care as a human rights issue. But what are the other rights that patients need to understand? And when one gets into the debate of physician-assisted suicide or euthanasia, you see extraordinary complexity and confusion. Patients have the right to refuse treatment, and patients often don't know that. They have the right to refuse nutrition and hydration. They have the right to refuse resuscitation. They have the right to pain relief. They have the right to choose the place of death. They have the right to aggressive palliative care. And this was probably best established in the U.S. in our own debates on physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia in our Supreme Court decision. And what are the attributes of palliative care? They're about choice, the choice to receive very aggressive active therapies or the choice to receive palliative care to have their symptom managed. The choice to die with dignity, and the dignity is being honored and respected for their own wishes. The opportunity for them to have hope, and hope simply for their own quality of living for the next day or for the next several days, and hope is construed by those with advanced illness. And incredibly autonomous, because there are various choices along the way that they're making, not doctors are making for them. It's their ability to clearly have a voice. So these are also sort of attributes on a rights-based perspective for the palliative care. I think another critical aspect, and I think you saw some of the quotes up there, palliative care is not euthanasia. It's not physician-assisted suicide, although I can say in the early beginnings of hospice, there was a concern that that's what it was all about. So I think we've been through that debate and had that settled. But it's, again, focused on the quality of living for those patients with serious life-threatening illnesses. It neither prolongs life or shortens life. Its intent is the quantity of life, is the quality of life rather than the quantity of life. And I'll keep reiterating this, but I think it's really important because I think what we became very clear of in the United States as we were having these debates is that people didn't understand what palliative care was, so therefore it was difficult for them to request it or ask for it or understand what approaches might be helpful for them. Recently, you've, in part of your debate, there's been a reflection published by your Quebec physicians called Physicians, Appropriate Care, and the Debate on Euthanasia. It's quite, to me, a very interesting and fascinating document in which it takes you through what are the, in fact, what would be the code of ethics for physicians and what should be the role of physicians. However, in the reflection, it doesn't really differentiate between euthanasia or assisted suicide. And I think this is critical to have clear definitions as we move forward in the rest of this discussion. Clearly, physician-assisted suicide has a specific definition. It's when the prescription or supplying of drugs with the explicit intention of enabling the patient to end his or her own life. Physician writes the prescription with the intent and with the dosage that is a lethal dosage. Euthanasia is the administration of drugs with the explicit intention of ending the patient's life at the patient's request. And so as we look at how these debates have evolved, these have been the definitions that I think are really quite well established, and it's important to stick to these definitions when we begin to talk about many of these discussions. the definition of palliative care, of assisted suicide, of euthanasia. In this reflection and the debate on euthanasia, there's a wonderful, very strongly supportive statement that palliative care, when accompaniment, is essential a part of the treatment, as the technical intervention has in a way become the example par excellence of appropriate care that is both personalized and proportional. So very, very strongly supports the constructs of what is good palliative care. But then there's this statement within the discussion of decision-making that says there's a new sensitivity that's clearly evident among both doctors and the public, that there are exceptional circumstances where euthanasia could be considered by patients and their loved ones and by doctors and other caregivers as a final step necessary to assure quality care at the very end. And I think this is an advocacy statement, but it's not necessarily a new sensitivity. It's been a sensitivity around for a very long period of time and one widely debated. And yet, this same document goes on to talking about the fact that this kind of process of deciding on the appropriate care is far too complex and too delicate to be reduced to certain specific conditions. And so the idea of having to accept a request for euthanasia due to a health system's inability to offer the appropriate care is absolutely unacceptable. So again, a very strong statement. And I must say, given the limited aspects of resources, this would almost make euthanasia not possible anywhere because of the way the current systems are trying to limit resources for patients, and particularly to the most extraordinarily vulnerable, those that are sick and dying. If we look internationally of what's happened in physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia, and I, again, don't plan to spend much time on this because I really want to spend time on how palliative care has helped us understand euthanasia. We have the experiences in Oregon, in Washington State, and most recently a court decision in Montana that supports physician-assisted suicide. None of these support euthanasia, and there was a strong, very, very sort of negative view against euthanasia occurring. So these are all physician-assisted suicide. When we move to Switzerland, euthanasia is accepted there. Belgium, the Netherlands, and most recently Luxembourg. But of all of these four countries, I think what's particularly, I think, an issue that has been brought up in the report and this reflection by Quebec physicians has been that euthanasia should be integral to palliative care. There's only one other group that have argued this, and this has been the Belgian group. The Dutch see them very, very separately. The Luxembourg group passed two different laws, one for palliative care and one for euthanasia. The Swiss see them very differently. So it's only the Belgian model that's been suggested, and in their suggestion that euthanasia is another option at the end of a palliative care pathway led to a trove of reports from the European Association of Palliative Care arguing very strongly that euthanasia is not palliative care. And I think, at least in Belgium, where that's being argued that it is, this is a belief unique to Belgium, not widely held in the rest of the world. So why is palliative care not an alternative? What would be some of the reasons? One, it's based on a view that even in a patient's most miserable moments, his or her life is worth living. That palliative care is the total care approach, focused on making suffering tolerable and sedation for the imminently dying an option. Whereas euthanasia really reflects a very opposite construct, it's not focused on the quality of living, but it's focused on ending life. If we look at our U.S. Supreme Court decision that rejected a federal constitutional right to assisted suicide, one of the important votes by Justice O'Connor and her summary of this Supreme Court decision, she argued very, very strongly and has been interpreted to giving Americans a right to palliative care, This is quite amazing because at the present time we don't have a right to health care, but we do have a right to, in this interpretation, a right to palliative care. But what was probably the most important about her discussion and her decision and her writings was that she made a very, very clear distinction between palliative care and aggressive palliative care and physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia and sedation. So this has been a very, very helpful legal framing for us in the United States. There's been also another component associated with advocacy for physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia, which is focused on how do we socially market something that the public might like or want. And what has been very, very clear, and this has been, you know, published by those supporting physician-assisted suicide or euthanasia, that there's a very strong negative reaction to the use of the word euthanasia by both the public and by healthcare professionals. Because basically, in all languages, in all interpretation, euthanasia means killing. So it's been tightly associated with that language. There's also been negative terms toward the use of a term called physician-assisted suicide. One, because of the use and sort of the connotations and stigma of suicide, and then that physicians would be assisting in a suicide. So this has had sort of a negative construct. And what emerged from these focus groups in social marketing was that the best way to talk about this topic would be to use language such as physician aid in dying, because that seemed to be the least polarized. So I tell you this only to suggest that there's a major sort of social marketing campaign going on about the language that we use around this issue. And I think we probably in palliative care could benefit from a better social marketing of palliative care. But I think as you see this language sort of creep into documents, it's trying to soften the language of euthanasia and soften and change the language related to physician-assisted suicide. This issue became even more confrontational when the advocacy group called Compassion and Choices in the United States, which has funneled 85% of the patients who have used and who have made available the use of physician-assisted suicide of Oregon. They have literally sponsored and helped champion them through the process. They threatened the Oregon Health Division unless they changed the language of how they referred to patients who had physician-assisted suicide. And so they began a process of bringing a suit against the state for the use of language. And what they wanted the language to be, that it was not patients who had had physician-assisted suicide, but rather those... which I think is, again, a way of framing how we talk about issues. There's also been sort of the public discussions about this. The National Review, clearly a conservative magazine, talking about the creeping culture of euthanasia. And then a Pulitzer Prize-winning Times reporter told the story of the Katrina victims, many of whom were given drugs prior to their death, in the setting of being unable to be evacuated from the various hospitals in New Orleans. And this article totally conflates aggressive palliative care with euthanasia and with physician-assisted suicide, but it's had an extraordinary, I think, impact on the discussions about these issues in the public domain. So if you've not read it, it's quite fascinating. There have been the typical jokes, since you have no right to health care, that's an American, but a right to physician-assisted suicide, take two aspirins and I'll kill you in the morning. So that was the Oregon joke. And there, when there were the others that were, again, all related to aspirin, before we try assisted suicide, let's give aspirin a chance. And I say this because there really are a enormous number of really quite witty constructs about the debate and how we think about them, and not meaning to trivialize it, but then in a way to find sort of the comic relief in it. There's a recent, there's a planned meeting here in Canada from May 17th to 21st, which I thought was quite fascinating because it, in a way, outlined what are the challenges as you talk about palliative care in Canada, and we talk about it really throughout the world. And this moving palliative care and end-of-life care forward is one that you can join by the Internet, which I thought, again, was a sort of very smart new technological innovation to participate in a meeting. But they put forth what were the challenges, and I think they're the challenges that we need to think about and address as we talk about palliative care. The first is the number of people dying is doubling with advanced planning needed for good deaths. This is Canada. This is the United States. Most, 89% of the people who die in Canada, are advanced in age or have advanced end-stage illness. Their care and support needs differ from those who die suddenly, different from emergency rooms. And this is the wonderful photojournalist story who you see there on the on your left as a young child being cared for by his grandfather and then as a young man caring for his grandfather. And this is the future that we all see as our aging population increases and as we have to provide care for those individuals with chronic illness, with dementing illnesses, with neurodegenerative diseases, with cancer. A third component or challenge is that, again, this major shift of death and dying out of the hospital has occurred without planning in Canada. I'm not an expert on some of your healthcare planning, so this is written by one of your own, arguing that this is a problem, leaving nursing homes and families with few resources to cope and greater palliative care and end-of-life care roles. And then finally, an issue that we have internationally is for those who live in rural and remote areas, how do we provide good care? How do we provide the kinds of services that are so needed? And this is, again, an important issue. So those are the challenges as we move forward in this debate. The other challenge I think that we all have to deal with is around the ethics of assisted suicide and euthanasia. And this really became really an important construct in New York State, where they put together a task force on end-of-life care. And within the task force, there were members who believed that assisted suicide and euthanasia were inherently wrong because the practices violate society's longstanding prohibition against ending human life. But there were other members of the committee that did not believe that assisted suicide and euthanasia were inherently unethical or incompatible with medical practice. And then there were a third group of members of the committee who were troubled by the prospect of medicalizing any of these practices. And they believe that physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia violates values that are fundamental to the practice of medicine and to the patient-physician relationship. And so I think we need to start with recognizing that, you know, within the audience there are people that have very different views on the ethics of this. But at least how we came to it in New York State was that it ended up being a unanimous decision, was that we should not have a public policy because we couldn't settle the ethics, and yet there were so many other concerns about medicalizing the practice. And so that's the kind of rational process that was used within the within New York State in our discussions. And it's the document is available, and it's a really very thoughtful document of how people disagreeing on the morality of this issue can come to terms with a discussion about public policy. So the big issues for Canada, for the world, are we have incredible advances in high technological support systems. We have this growing incidence and prevalence of both cancer and AIDS, and with other illnesses that are requiring expensive drugs and expensive care. We have an aging population. We all have limitations on healthcare resources. We are witnessing, I think, probably the greatest reduction in community and social supports that we've seen ever in our histories. And a strong emphasis on individual rights. So as we deal with these issues, how do we begin to address them? And so again, if I look to Canada, David Coole, who was one of our faculty scholars in our project on death in America, as part of his PhD thesis, interviewed patients who were dying and was able to identify what they would want. And then after meeting and talking with the patients, they strongly encouraged him to write a book for the public about these issues. I think David even made it to being on Oprah, which not many of us ever do. And what this book does is distill advice to patients, how to talk with their providers, how to learn the questions to ask from the specialist, how to find out about alternative treatments, how to consider dying at home or in another setting, and guidance on emotional issues. And he's gone on to write a series of other texts, but I think the important aspect is this is the kind of information that patients, as he interviewed and studied, kept saying, we wished we had had this information. We have never died before. We don't understand this process. And so it's, I think, a critically important kind of information that the public needs when we're having these discussions. Another text, another Canadian text that comes from comparison studies here in Montreal and then in the state of Pennsylvania, is a book that doctors Barnard and Anna Towers published, and it's called Crossing Over. And it's this wonderful set of narratives of patients and families, of their lived experience, of their nuanced portraits of their experience. And you can really see and hear the differences in relationships between the formal setting of care, that is the doctor side, and then the lived experience for patients. And so these were palliative care patients. And what these palliative care patients, again, taught us about euthanasia was that they had never died before. They didn't understand the process. They didn't know what choices they might have. They didn't know how to make those choices. They didn't know how to talk about these issues. They didn't know how to talk about them with their families. And at least for the American population, the enormous worry they had around finances. So the distinction in this book, the Canadian population didn't seem to be too worried about money. The Americans were obsessed with the cost of care, so they saw real differences in these studies. Having spent some time working with this, the group Not Dead Yet, and with a variety of other disability groups who are more sort of middle of the road, and in fact some quite radical to the left, who've been strongly against physician-assisted suicide, you only, again, need to hear their narratives of their inability to obtain from the healthcare system appropriate care and to be really at very many different times in emergency rooms thought to be clearly stigmatized by their disability, not capable of making decisions, their decisions not being respected, and when their decisions required more resources, those resources being refused. So their important construct of Not Dead Yet is incredibly powerful in any kind of a public policy that would in any way diminish their ability to obtain care, they found threatening. And so they rapidly allied themselves with the dying because they saw their issues very much the same. Doctors didn't understand them. They didn't know what they needed. They didn't know how to treat their symptoms. And, you know, a list that was very impressive and really quite moving. Again, from the palliative care literature, and this is from a colleague of mine, Nessa Coyle, who is a PhD nurse at Memorial, who looked at patients who had an expressed desire for hastened death. This was part of a PhD thesis, and she identified that there were these sort of incredible overarching themes to what patients said. These are patients in an active tertiary cancer center. How hard it was to work in the and to work at living in the face of death. And then the rather profound existential suffering that patients experienced, and what she identified as the existential slap. And that was typically the time when the patients were told that their therapies were unsuccessful, that they, in fact, there were no other treatments made available to them. And it was in this kind of a setting that patients expressed a desire for hastened death, but consistently acknowledged profound ambivalence, and acknowledged that they really were wanting continued existence. They were just trying to shape what that continued existence might be. Harvey Chachanoff, another Canadian, has, and again another faculty scholar of our project on Death in America, did really extraordinary research, again, studying hundreds of patients now who had a desire for hastened death, and identified that their symptoms of pain, their lack of family supports, led to depressive symptoms and led to this desire to die. And then, more importantly, He developed a very, very innovative therapeutic approach for this patient population, which was a dignity-conserving therapy, and working with patients and teaching them and helping them identify what their major concerns were. And within this process, I think what we've had is this opportunity to, again, to hear what patients are saying, to hear their concerns. And although their concerns are framed in a desire to die, they really are framed in a desire to live, but with a reduction in suffering, with improved care, with reducing burden to their family. And when one hears Harvey talk about this and sees the research, the social dignity inventory is really quite extraordinary, because what patients experience in the setting of a significant illness are incredible boundaries around privacy for them, often lack of social support. What Harvey says is how the care tenor is so important, how people use literally the tone of their language in how they care for individual patients, the construct of burden, and then what happens afterwards. And so these dignity-conserving perspectives and practices have been an incredibly important therapeutic approach for patients who are expressing a desire to death. So there is much that can be done for those patients who wish to hasten death, and when one begins the process of working with them, you readily begin to see that this is not about their desire for death, but their desire for a better life. And these change over time, again, the ambivalence and the fluctuations. Here's the patient's will to live changing dramatically with the degree of pain. And this has been my own experience in working at Memorial. When I was at first a young attending there, the number of patients I would see who would repeatedly say to me, "I just want to die, help me die right now." And we'd say, "Well, could we have a chance to get your pain under control?" And we'd get their pain under control, and it wasn't that hard because they were getting probably little to no drug. And their pain would be under control, and they would say, "Well, of course, I don't want to die. I'm not in pain." And these are what patients tell us repeatedly. And again, this summary of the work of Chachanov, which was initially published in Lancet and now a series of articles on dignity-conserving therapy, is that this construct of a desire to death, a loss of will to live, depression, hopelessness, anxiety, are all very, very closely bonded. And it requires a lot of sophistication on the part of the healthcare professional, on the part of the family, to tease these apart and to think and to address them in ways that are fruitful and helpful. In the COIL studies, coming back to those, what were the meanings and the uses of this expressed desire? And I think here, probably what I've learned as the clinician in all of this, is that we who care for these patients and think that we know them do not know them at all. And so what Nessa identified, that the variabilities that were most frequently associated with this desire for hastened death were depression, hopelessness, pain, low intensity of religious beliefs, and inadequate family supports. So clearly correlating very closely the work of Harvey Chachanov and now the work of many others. And she synthesized this into a framework of how we think perhaps to me, clearly as a neuro-oncologist, was to have their physicians listen to them. And their sense that we didn't listen to them. The vulnerability to the oncologist, who is, in fact, an enormous power. Their concern that they would be abandoned if they didn't go on the next phase one trial. Rich language and often stormy communication in the incredible vulnerability of this population. So to think that we need to listen to them more, we need to hear what they're saying, and we need, as healthcare professionals, to be able to be open to this whole discussion. In this whole debate, there's another population we have to think about as vulnerable. I've talked about the disabled. I've talked about the very sick, vulnerable population that we've learned about. And then there are minority populations. And I think we didn't appreciate this, that we had a project in the U.S. which was to focus on improving end-of-life care broadly. And we wanted to reach out to minority populations, and we did. And a minority physician, Richard Payne, who's a pain expert, who at that point was head of our palliative care program at Memorial, led the effort. He was really blown away by his experiences. His first experience was with a patient that he was caring for, a black man with prostate cancer. And at that time, Rich was working at MD Anderson. And he suggested to this patient with very advanced illness that it was probably time to think about palliative care. And the patient said, "Are you crazy? I want everything. And this is an institution that wouldn't let me through the door 20 years ago. And now you want me to take second-class care." He was so affronted by that because he thought he was doing the best for a patient, his same ethnic background, the same own personal experiences. So he brought together a large number of African-American physicians and African-American patients, and clearly what repeatedly we saw was they were enormously suspicious of hospice and palliative care. Very suspicious of anyone that would talk about physician-assisted suicide or euthanasia. They viewed the denial of death as really a healthy response, and they had little credibility in institutions. And so the concern is, with a public policy for assisted suicide, for euthanasia, this moves those minorities further away from trusting the healthcare system. This was most evident in Australia, when in the Northern Territories the euthanasia law was passed, and the Aboriginal population, which is quite large there, immediately said, "We're not going to doctors. We're afraid now that doctors can kill us." And they heard that. They didn't fully understand it, but it took a major campaign to assure the Aboriginal population that the availability of euthanasia, which was available, I think, for about a year and a half, and then the law was changed, of limiting their fearfulness. So I think we need to think about our minority populations and how they're impacted by this. There are these other aspects that I think are quite fascinating, and I'm only giving you a list, but for each one there's a literature on it, some that's anecdotal and some that's quite validated. What about healthcare professionals' views on this issue? Because, again, they have their own views, and they have very strong views. So it appears that young doctors are more likely in favor of assisted suicide and older doctors are not. Female doctors are more likely to be against physician-assisted suicide. They're the caretakers. And men would be more likely in favor of it. Those that are more religious are against, and those that are less religious or have no religious beliefs would be for it. Those that have personal values about how healthcare resources are used, and we studied this in a neurology population, those that want to limit, think that resources have to be limited, are totally for physician-assisted suicide. The medical specialty seems to play a little bit of a role, but not very profound. The practice setting, very much so. And clearly, this construct of and perspectives about financial resources. So would a patient then have to go and interview the doctor and ask them to sort of list their views personally about each of these issues to say, are you, more supportive or less supportive of this issue? So it raises that kind of a question. Let me tell you a few minutes about Oregon, and then I'll close. In the United States, we've had this experiment with Oregon as a laboratory, and we were hoping it would be a laboratory of the states. And to date, there have been about 460 patients who have taken advantage of the Oregon Death with Dignity law. It's quite a secretive process because there's no independent evaluator, as there is in the Netherlands and in other countries, and there's enormous censorship of any kind of released information. This is the number of deaths over time, and the blue is the number. Blue is the number of deaths, and the green is the number of prescriptions. And you see this mismatch. And what is quite fascinating, at every year, up to 30 to 40% of patients who've given a prescription never take it and live for 2 years or longer. And I'll give you a case example of this sort of mismatch. So what is there in a prescription that might not be in dignity-conserving therapy? Why couldn't we do a randomized controlled trial of this and look at these issues? But again, we've not had that opportunity because the system is very closed, the data is guarded, we know very little. But what we do know from some studies that Linda Ganzini has done is that 46% of patients, and this was in an early study done in Oregon, they've stopped all these studies, 46% of patients offered a palliative care consultation never pursued physician-assisted suicide. Less than 5% of patients have a psychiatric consultation. Yet I've shown you the work of Harvey Chachanov. I've shown you the work of our own group. Patients with a desired death, we think, should have full assessments. This is not happening in Oregon. There's no data when physicians refuse to aid a patient, and there's no data accumulated to see how many physicians a patient has to see before they're given assistance. So we don't know how doctors are agreeing or disagreeing. And lastly, the median time the patient knows the prescribing physician is no more than 12 weeks. So these are doctors for hire, one could consider. It raises many different issues and a concern that we think we would like to study. More importantly, in Oregon, you do not have to have unbearable suffering to request assistance in death. You simply have to have an illness that doctors will agree and prognosticate will lead to your death in 6 months or less. The patients who have used and made themselves available of this treatment have been white, college-educated, without severe pain or suffering. And their major concern is a future concern. So it's not unbearable suffering at this point in time, but this issue of future concerns. Prognostication has been invalid, but we anticipated that because we know doctors are wrong 50% of the time. And most of the patients are coming through the advocacy group, Compassion and Choices. And there's lots written about advocacy groups and how patients are channeled in any disease treatment. So it raises questions that we would like to know more about. So the lack of transparency and openness in the process has led us to made the Oregon Health Division become more a supporter for the process, but we've called it, you know, don't ask and don't tell. So it would be so useful if we could have more information about this process. And should you ever vote for physician-assisted suicide or euthanasia here, don't follow the Oregon experience. There are better experiences. The data that they keep is rather limited for each year. And yet, in any one year, a physician might write 8 to 12 prescriptions. They tell you that data. Well, over a 10-year period, that could mean that one physician is writing 80 prescriptions or 100 prescriptions, but the data is not kept, so we have no way to know this. And the point I'm attempting to make is to suggest, is there a group of physicians that everyone goes to who does this? And is that good or is that bad? I'm not making a value judgment, but I think we should have the opportunity to know that information and better understand it. Because one of the requirements is that a patient has to be seen by two physicians in order to be able to obtain full permission to receive physician-assisted suicide. So there is a belief that you only will refer to someone who has the same beliefs that you have in this process. So let me tell you one example, which is the challenge of how do we, as a society and a public policy, deal with suicide behaviors on one side and physician-assisted suicide. This is a case published in the Archives of General Psychiatry, and it's a patient from Oregon. He was a 63-year-old male. He had lung cancer. And on the same day, he called up a group called Physicians for Compassionate Care requesting physician-assisted suicide. He thought they were the group that would help him. As it turned out, it was a volunteer who began a series of phone calls with him, learned that he had had two previous suicide attempts, learned that his mother had committed suicide, and that he had a past history of alcoholism. And she was someone who worked for the advocacy group to prevent physician-assisted suicide. She also was a very respected suicide counselor. She assured the patient of access to palliative care. She intervened with his primary care physician to treat him for depression, and he went on to receive cancer treatment. He had concurrently called two physicians from Compassion and Choices, or associated with Compassion and Choices. They were known to be physician-assisted suicide activists, and one of them gave him a lethal prescription. the one giving it to him was a psychiatrist. Note. Neither physician thought he was depressed and did not take a psychiatric history. 18 months after his initial diagnosis, so again, wrong about prognostication, this is 18 months later, he becomes quite combative and agitated. He's diagnosed with a depressive disorder. He's admitted to the hospital. On discharge, he's assigned a guardian. He had guns in his home, and these were removed, but not his lethal prescription for drug overdose. So the psychiatrist wanting to prevent his suicide was sort of confronted with this sort of legal challenge of him having these legal doses at home. He eventually died at home with really excellent pain control and reconnected to his daughter. But it leads to this discussion of how do we create a public policy for both suicide and physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia, and how do we think about this? And here it is, how we've learned this in trying to care for this person. Let me skip to just a few more facts. In this construct of communicating with patients at the end of life and being able to understand their distress, other studies have told us that 50% of patients report moderate to severe pain in the last days of life. And this is data from our support study. It was a 1995 study in our major hospitals in the U.S. in patients who were identified as having very advanced illness and looked like they were dying. If we look at the AIDS population, it's about 80%. If we look at the elderly, it's about 39%. And these are people who have been identified, and these are the prevalences of pain. Probably of greater significance, if we look at the elderly, the geriatric population, in a study by Conwell and Kane, that 75% of elderly patients who committed suicide had been seen by their primary care physician in the previous month, and this was not even evaluated or discussed. We did a major survey of American neurologists looking at their attitudes and behaviors around end-of-life care and palliative care. And we found, again, sort of their, we referred to it as the ignorance-arrogance study. 39% of neurologists agreed with the statement that in a patient dying of ALS, treating dyspnea with morphine sufficient to decrease their breathing is euthanasia. Nowhere, including our Supreme Court decision, has said that this is euthanasia. This is good palliative care. So they don't know that. 39% of neurologists. 44% of neurologists agreed with the statement that it's illegal to give painkillers in doses that risk respiratory depression to the point of death. These are really smart colleagues of mine, and it just speaks to the fact that they don't understand these issues around palliative care and confuse them with euthanasia. So that's why the definitions are so important. So from my own perspective, the really critical issues is that we need to address patients' requests for a hastened death, for a desire to death, and it takes time. And it doesn't take one visit, it takes multiple visits, and it takes a setting of care. We all, as clinicians, physicians and nurses, other healthcare professionals, need to develop our responses to this complex issue. It's been argued that if you refuse to assist a patient in their death, then you're abandoning them. And yet, there's every bit of reason to think that if you agree to assist in their death, that that's even a greater form of abandonment. And that openly discussing their request and describing your own role, the physician's role, is often difficult and critical but needs to happen. And so it's quite possible and real for physicians to say, this is not what I do. And I think clearly, if we take Luxembourg as the example, physicians here have clearly said, we are palliative care physicians, this is not what we do. So it's called, you know, creating these bright lines. But all of this is complex, is difficult, and so I'm just going to flash through my slides right now to take you to the last slide, because I think that's probably the best of statements. This is a book by Daniel Callahan, who was head of the Hastings Institute, a philosopher and an ethicist. And he wrote a book called The Troubled Dream of Life, and if you've not had the opportunity to read it, it's really quite thoughtful. And so his perspective on this topic, I think, has been helpful to me, again, from a public policy perspective, is that there's a peculiar irony in the contention that in cases of severe suffering, our human dignity can only be achieved by having another person kill us or by providing us with the means to kill ourselves. It is a way of saying that we cannot achieve dignity on our own in some circumstances, but must turn to the community to make it possible, and at least to one other person to make it physically possible, and the society more generally to make it legally possible. Yet it is a strange kind of community that require consensual homicide to realize its members' individual dignity. And so I think as we think about these topics and talk about them, we, clearly the healthcare professionals, need to be better at providing care, to be having these discussions, to be engaging the public with these discussions. And at the same time, we need to be respecting the dignity of our patients and allowing them to die with dignity, and pushing hard for them to have access to the best of resources for palliative care. So thank you for this opportunity to be here with you, and I'm glad to answer some questions.
Thanks a lot, Dr. Folley. There are two microphones at the back, two at the front, so we welcome people to come up quietly while I give you a few little other house rules. If you have mobility challenges or if you're just shy, lift up your hand and we'll get you a piece of paper to write down a question, or we'll bring you a mic, we'll figure something out so that everybody will get a chance. And one last plea is please ask a question. We want to take advantage of Dr. Fowley's big brain. Don't make a lecture. We can invite you back to give a lecture on another time if you feel a need. There's a lot of room here in the auditorium, but tonight it's her stage. So if we have someone who wants to come up and ask the first question, go ahead, sir.
Yes, I've often wondered how I did. I was a volunteer in palliative care. Some years ago, I walked in, the man and his wife were there. The man said, "I've talked to three rabbis, nobody has an answer for me. What's your faith?" And I said, "I'm not here for that. I can just tell you a story. We have spring, summer, and then fall and winter." And then I spent a few more minutes listening and left. The next week he wasn't there, and then about a month later I was walking and his wife walked in, hugged me, thanking me. He'd gone to a hospital and he'd asked all his family to come so he could say goodbye. And I have never completely understood what went on.
Well, it seems like you may have made some impact in the care of that patient, but I agree with you. I remain continually find difficulty in understanding the meaning that people find in our words, but also the critically important aspect of our words to them. So perhaps you gave them some insight into their lives.
Many of the discussions and debates involving palliative care or euthanasia tend to deal with rather abstract questions. The right to life, the right to die with dignity, the right to have pain relief, professional ethics, etc. But there's very little discussion of things on the ground, in the sense that why are there no agencies available to provide information for those who want it and agencies to monitor what actually happens? Who asks the questions of why doctors did not give adequate pain relief or provide psychiatric care? Because unless we have these agencies, no matter what system you're going to devise, we're going to have terrible abuses. So why isn't a discussion about actual methods to provide humane treatment and intelligent advice?
Well, I mean, I'll give you some. There are some of us who think that there are many of these agencies out there, but people don't know how to access them. We've also found that, and this was a major issue in the United States, which I will agree with you, when we looked at how our National Cancer Institute talked about end-of-life care, they had one report, and it was called Living with Cancer. So I think talking about death and dying with the public has been an enormous challenge, and any suggestions that you might have would be really helpful. From the pain perspective, I can tell you there's extraordinary information on the Internet through the Canadian Pain Association, through the American Pain Association, through the International Association for the Study of Pain, that are very practical, very pragmatic, very useful. So there really is, I would say, from the pain perspective, enormous information out there that
No, but that's not what I'm asking. What I'm asking is, why didn't somebody ask why patients were not given the medication for pain relief, since we know that there's widespread abuse here? Who asks those questions? Who admonishes people for not doing their professional duties? Who tells the families of the victims that they can and should complain?
Right. I'm sorry, I misinterpreted what you're saying. Again, and I'm not defending any of these systems because I'm with you. Each physician should be held accountable. Each hospital should be accountable. So the way that we tried to address that in the United States was to make sure that our JCO, which is the Joint Committee that accredits hospitals, insisted that every patient should have their pain measured and monitored, and that monitoring of that pain should be a way that we would assess whether they were adequately treated to build in the accountability. But I agree with you that we don't have a good accountable system, and we need patient advocates. And something that we don't fully understand is why haven't we had the same sort of movement of patient advocacy around the pain issue or around the end-of-life care issue as we have around so many disease-specific issues? What is there about this topic or these topics? When that's been studied, again, by the social marketers, patients often say that pain is a low priority when they're seeing their doctor and want to hear about their disease treatment. That's what patients tell us. Second, families say we're so exhausted through the care of our family member that we can't spend time being involved in these advocacy groups. There have been a series of cases in the U.S. that have been brought against doctors and against hospitals, and we've moved to litigation, and we think that's an approach. And we've been working with the Human Rights Council at an international level and with the human rights organizations to make this visible. So there's litigation, there's advocacy, but the difficulty has been, why does the public not feel so outraged about this? In my own institution, we decided that we needed every physician to have a family member with cancer and had pain to make them change how they treated patients. It's that kind of, you know, personal experience, but one does not want to wish that on anyone, but it was that kind of need to be able to people to act outraged and to be outraged. So there's an enormous need for this and an accountability piece.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm having a little trouble seeing this side because of the light, so if there's someone at that mic, wave your hand and we'll go to you. Yes? Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, first of all, thank you very much for the lecture. Very enlightening. And Two reasons I found it very enlightening were the fact that you mentioned often constructs, how we think about things. And you also gave importance to language. So my question is, at the risk of asking you to give another summary of your lecture, what construct or how should we be thinking about euthanasia? Is, for example, the question about whether or not euthanasia is good for us at a societal and cultural level and at an individual level, a valid question? And what language should we be using to get an answer, to find an answer?
I think that we need to have the discussions around what that language means. I think we need to have people, you know, again, be willing to talk and be those who advocate for it being morally justified and those who argue against it, to be able to have those open discussions. And then I think the construct has to be, what are the implications of such a public policy? And the concerns that I have within that debate and the constructs, I would say, well, what will be the impact on doctors? The profession of medicine is to keep a patient alive. And do we really want to be cared for by, I mean, in the United States, we don't trust doctors to take care of us. Why are we going to trust them to kill us? So, I mean, one has to begin to think of these issues. What's the impact on the profession when you don't have to try that hard because you can just say, well, I guess we could just euthanize you today. Let me tell you, that's so much easier than having to have 20 family meetings, come up with 10 different drug regimens, argue and fight with a system of for resources for those patients. So I think we have to look at what will that do to the profession. And then what will it do, as I say, to these vulnerable minority groups who don't trust the system so far and know that that's something in your armamentarium that you might offer? And then do we want doctors going around and offering this to patients? Would you like to see your doctor and you have a serious complaint and have him say, well, you know, we could just euthanize you. Do you want that conversation? And then do we want, if we really want to talk about autonomy, do we want to give our autonomy to the doctor who would control the prescription, control the timing? You know, we can make fallacies about how much control we might have, but it would be the doctor who would decide it was okay. It would be the doctor who would write the prescription. Do we want to do that as a society? So I think those are the societal discussions about what kind of a society are we, how do we care for the suffering and the vulnerable, what constructs that we have, and who do we trust, and who do we need to set boundaries for because they may not be trustable.
I want to ask you a quick question. You mentioned a couple of times New York doesn't have a law. You talked about the shortcomings of Oregon's law. Do we need laws and regulations for this, or is it better without them?
I can tell you that the Hemlock Society wanted very much to have no laws. And they argue, and this has been sort of an underground grassroots movement of individuals who want to totally take control, store up drugs, and help other people die. And so when Derek Humphrey was confronted with the legislation, he argued strongly, we don't want any laws because then they'll start controlling us and containing those laws. There's been a sense that if we have legislation that we could be more protective. But we hoped that Oregon would be that experiment. And because of the secrecy and the lack of transparency, we don't know if there are problems because we're not allowed to know about them. I think in the Netherlands, where there was no law and it was allowed, and then in 2001 the law was finally passed, with that law has come a series of greater restrictions. And increasingly, they're seeing that doctors are not complying with the law. They're just not reporting. So I think there are those who would argue that no law is better than a law that is totally constricted in this process.
Again, I'm having a little trouble seeing at the back. And if people, I see someone over there. And if you don't want to go to the mic, you're shy, wave your hand and we'll get someone to you as well. So we'll go up over.
This is a comment, not a question, but I just wanted to say that I found this talk very useful in the sense that you gave us a lot of facts about this debate, which is often a very emotional debate, and there's a lot of passion on both sides of the question. And a lot of it is fueled by a lack of knowledge of the fact, as you said, that we can refuse treatment if we want to, that we can have good palliative care that is not euthanasia, that the desire to die is often something that's not permanent and that's fueled by depression and many other psychological issues. So I think the facts that you've given us today help us to have a much more rational debate and to hopefully approach this issue in a more reasonable way. So thank you for that.
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you, Dr. Foley. Stanford University put forward a program that is adopted by the Montreal Neurological Institute called Self-Management for Chronic Disease. Mm-hmm. And you touched on it. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to put forward advocacy for an action plan to interrelate both that idea and the palliative care needs of self-management programs. Mm-hmm. I don't know who's going to do it. I don't know who's going to take care of it. Right. But you have a layman's opinion.
No, I think clearly any public health strategy very much and strongly supports a construct of self-management. But one of the difficulties that we faced in trying to broadly engage the public in this issue is that no one wants to talk about their dying till they're there. And so there was a hope, and there still is a hope in the U.S., that the baby boomers would be the answer to our problem, because they like to talk about things, and they like to have information, and they're going through the process with their parents. And so there's this, again, a social marketing movement to engage that population in self-management and in giving people lots of information about the different kind of choices, so that when they see their doctor, there's some information. But when they see their lawyer, he has tons of information. And when they see their pastor, he also has lots of information. So again, part of our efforts have been to move to the churches, to move to our legal system, to move to other places where people might get this information for self-management and basically give it back to the community. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation did this, and again, I think Canada has demonstrated many of these kinds of efforts, these community statewide efforts where everybody who's involved with the care of the patient who's seriously ill all come together and say, how do we do this, and how do we talk with you, and how do we educate the public? But you know, you can't educate the public about something they don't want to be educated about. So that's the challenge. So when do people want to hear about this? How do they want to hear about it? In what form is helpful to them? And I think we don't fully understand that. And clearly in the United States, where, you know, death is clearly a second choice issue, it's not a conversation we found that people want to have.
I think I see someone back there waving. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah. Hi, Dr. Foley. Thank you very much for your presentation. As you have mentioned during your presentation, that there's a trend where the younger generation tend to be more open to the idea of euthanasia. I'm a medical student, a third-year medical student, and in a recent discussion about euthanasia with fellow younger students, I was astounded by how many younger medical students are very open to the idea of euthanasia. And I was wondering, where do you think that stems, and how can we remedy this situation, if this can be called a remedy?
I don't think there's a remedy. I think that's a wonderful aspect of youth. So I think that we need to give them the opportunity to see the complexity of that issue. And once they have the opportunity to be with patients in a hospice program or to be with patients in a palliative care program and begin to see that this is so much more complicated than a choice issue or an autonomous issue, I think that that's what really provides them with that perspective. So I don't think I think the debates are fun. I think they are wonderful at arguing about them. The Junior American Medical Association came out in favor of physician-assisted suicide. And I think that many people looked on that as just give them some time in the trenches. Just give them some time with patients. Let them understand what's possible. And I think that changes your attitudes. I think clearly the experience of caring for patients humbles me every day and changes my perspective on the extraordinary opportunity there is to care for this patient population to improve their quality of living. So I think they just need time and effort and they need really good role models. So hopefully they'll have the opportunity, and clearly here in Canada you have really extraordinary role models. They just need those role models to see what's possible, and that may alter their perspectives, but it may not. But there is a funny piece to this. So I don't know if you probably all have seen the Ali G shows, because when I was telling my son I was giving this talk, he told me that I should start with the Ali G show. So Ali G brought together a series of famous ethicists to interview them. They didn't know that he was Ali G and he was putting them on. And so he said, "I just don't understand what your problem with euthanasia is." And he meant youth in Asia. And he led them down this whole discussion of youth in Asia.
Thank you.
So I want to ask you one last quick little question before we wrap up. I want you to look to the future. Do you foresee a future where palliative care is an integral part of care?
I sure hope so, because I spend a lot of time doing that. Yes. We've had really enormous support at an international level. You know, of the 192 countries that belong to the WHO, about 140 of those countries are beginning to think about how to integrate palliative care into their healthcare policies. We're seeing the human rights community being our advocates and arguing that human rights is that palliative care and pain relief are human rights issues and need to be taken up. And we're seeing really extraordinary opportunity of how palliative care structures and in way models the best of a healthcare system, of being patient-centered, of being family-centered, of being centered on the total patient. So I think the future is, I think, that countries will have palliative care policies integrated into their healthcare policies. But it's probably going to take another 50 years to get there, but in the short term, I think the advances that have happened in the U.S., in Canada, and Australia are enormous. We have more to go, but I think at least in developed countries we've seen it, and in resource-poor countries we're seeing it as part of the cancer control program, as part of an AIDS strategy, now even as part of TB strategies, where these are embedded in the documents of these strategies. So I think that this is a movement whose time is coming, and part of it has come.
And I'd now like to welcome Dr. Bernard Lapointe to thank tonight's guest lecturer formally, and save some more of your applause. Dr. Lapointe est chef de division des soins palliatifs à l'Hôpital Général Juif. He's also the Eric M. Flanders Chair in Palliative Medicine at McGill University and Director of the Department of Palliative Care at McGill. Dr. Lapointe.
Thank you. Well, my job tonight is the easiest one. It is to thank a lot of people, and starting with you. I think that I want, on behalf of the Council, of which I am a very proud member, the Council on Palliative Care, I would like to thank each and every one of you for being here tonight. I came to palliative care during the AIDS epidemic, and I still remember that vibrant slogan we had, silence equals death. And for me, tonight is the living proof that we all value life, and that when we allow for discussion and proper reflection, we're all partaking into life. And thank you for this. Thank you, Mr. Picard, for helping us host this evening, and for your very gracious way you introduced the speaker and the questions. Dr. Foley, how can I thank you? You've been a leader, a model, a mentor for everyone in Montreal who's involved in palliative care. I have a profound admiration for your work in the U.S., at the Open Society, with WHO, because we always forget how critical your contribution has been in making sure that palliative care is available not only in North America, in a resource-rich country, but it is now being more and more available in resource-poor countries. And that's very, very important. So as a small token of our thank, here's a little thank for you. And a very little thing for you, Doctor. And finally, I would like to thank the family of Sandra Goldberg, who made this event possible, and would welcome you and will invite you to watch our website of the Council for next year's presentation and for the activities throughout the year. Thank you very much. Refreshments, reception is being held in the lobby of the Pollack Hall. Thank you again, and let's hope we will win this evening. Bye-bye.